mysteries and pleasures of quantum spin systems. So I have to try to squeeze into 1 hour what I really need 1.5 hours for, but let's see if we can do it. So yesterday we just looked at this quantum phase transition again. I just showed that we can we can see the Binder ratio crossing points here, and we can extract the critical point to be around 1.91. Let me just show you the spin stiffness, which we also discussed yesterday. We discussed it, but we didn't really do anything with it. Today in the tutorial, you will, as I said, look at the spin stiffness and other things for the 2D uniform system. Now let's look at the spin stiffness at a quantum phase transition. So this is what scaling theory predicts for the spin stiffness at a critical point in D dimensions and with dynamic exponent Z. So we discussed this dynamic exponent yesterday. So remember, it's the exponent which relates the length and space and time length scales. So in these systems, we expect Z to be 1. So to analyze the stiffness, what one often does is to multiply by a factor of power of L, which makes this size independent. So in this case, what we should do is take L times rho S and then graph that for different L, and then we should get crossing points reflecting the size independence of that quantity at the critical point. So this should hold exactly at the critical point. In the magnetic phase, you should have a finite spin stiffness, so that means that this thing there should actually grow as L. And in the magnetically disordered phase, it should decay very fast. So that means it actually crosses. Now, if you look at this kind of system, if you remember how we defined the spin stiffness as this change in boundary conditions, it's clear that since the system is not rotationally invariant, it breaks this lattice rotational symmetry, we have a stiffness in the x and y direction, and they are not expected to be the same, except when J1 equals J2. So here you see an analysis of this kind, L times rho x and L times rho y, and you see that similar to the previous case, of the Binder ratio, we get these curve crossings, but there's some significant drift in the crossing points. So those reflect corrections to scaling. But if one can even take those scaling corrections into account, then one can get a very accurate number for this critical point. One nice thing here is that you see that these crossing points accumulate from the right, whereas in this Binder ratio, they accumulate from the left, so we can always somehow bracket the critical point in that way. So that's nice, although by no means necessary. Okay, so I don't want to say much more about these transitions. A lot of work has done, and actually still being done. There are still some controversial issues actually related to this kind of systems, in particular the one where we put the strong couplings in a staggered fashion. I showed that lattice also, I think, a couple of days ago. Now let me talk about this valence bond basis, which is an alternative to the standard basis of up and down spins, also when we do calculations. So we discussed this a little bit on a more qualitative level already. Now let's do something quantitative with this basis. So let's first look at not the valence bond basis, but just a static singlet triplet basis. So if we pair the spins up, for example, in columns like this, we have four states of two spins, right? And normally, when we just work with spin up and down, those are just up, down, down, up, 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 down, down. Now, equally well, we could just work with the singlet and triplets on those bonds. So that's also four states, right? There's one singlet and three triplets. So this would be the zero magnetization triplet, and this the down, and this the up triplet. So that's also a completely normal, complete basis. And in fact, people sometimes do analytical calculations in this basis. Now let's look at what's called the valence bond basis. So this basis, I should again say, this spans the full Hilbert space, of course. Now, if we are just interested in a singlet state, and often the ground states of these models that we have been talking about are singlets, we can work in a basis with only singlets. But, of course, then the singlets cannot be static, because that's just one state. If you just keep the singlets here, that's just one single state, and of course it doesn't span much of the Hilbert space at all. But if we let those singlet tilings be arbitrary, we get, in fact, an overcomplete basis, meaning that there are many more of those singlet tilings than there are actual singlets in the Hilbert space. So it's an overcomplete basis. We can also do higher spin states. So, for example, an overcomplete basis in the triplet sector would just be to have one triplet bond in this singlet soup. And then we can expand any singlet in terms of all kinds of states like that, and we can expand the triplet in states like that. So one thing I should point out is that normally when we work in these with these singlet bases, we work on bipartite lattices. And then normally one restricts these singlets or these valence bonds to connect only sites on different sublattices. So here you see sublattices A, B, A, B, A, B, and so on a chain, and these bonds connect different sublattices. And I put an arrow on the bonds here, which normally we don't do, but just for clarity, that the arrow corresponds to the order in which we write the up and down spins in the singlet. So we have a choice here. We could write here, like I did here, up, down, minus, down, up, with A first, or I could put it in the reverse order, which just corresponds to a minus sign, of course. So the convention normally is that we fix these arrows to go from A to B, which corresponds to this definition. And that fixes the sign, of course, of the whole wave function if we use that convention for all the bonds. And we will see in a moment why we fix it like that. So any singlet state then can be expanded in terms of these singlet tilings. So here I use this same notation for a singlet. So this is a singlet product, and alpha refers to all the possible tilings of these singlets. And since the basis is overcomplete, there are these expansion coefficients. So this is just the shorthand notation I will use for a valence bond basis state. These expansion coefficients are not unique, right? Because the basis is overcomplete. There are more states of that kind than actual singlet basis states, so these coefficients cannot be unique. Okay, so why do we use this convention? Well, it turns out that if we work on a bipartite, meaning unfrustrated system, these expansion coefficients now can be all positive. And that's really the reason that we can do a lot of nice work in this basis. And that corresponds to what's called the Marshall sign rule. So if you look back in the basis of up and down spins, you just express all these valence bonds in terms of their up, down, down, up components, you will see that the sign of a given spin configuration will be given by minus 1 raised to the power of the number of up spins on sublattice. Here I wrote A, it should actually be B again. No, it's like this, yeah. It doesn't matter, it's just an overall sign, but you could put B here, maybe that would actually conform to what I did there. So, the signs of the wave function are not all positive. They are positive and negative in a specific pattern, which is called the Marshall sign rule. And one can prove, I don't have time to do it, but actually the proof is also very simple, that the ground state of a bipartite system satisfies that sign rule. Okay, one can use some variational arguments to show that, but I don't have time to do it. Anyway, so that's the convention we use. Now let's look at some calculations with valence bond states. So I mentioned that the basis is overcomplete. It's also a non-orthogonal basis, and in fact, all the basis states have some overlap with each other. So if we look at two valence bond states and we want to compute their overlap, What we do actually is somehow very appealing in some sense. We take the bond configurations, we superimpose them. That's called the transposition graph. And then you can see that some loops are forming in this transposition graph. There will always be only closed loops, and the shortest loop is this kind where the bonds are on the same, where they coincide. So it turns out that the overlap of these states can be expressed as 2 raised to the number of loops minus n over 2. And why is that? Well, if we put the spins back in this valence bond picture, so here I draw these bonds coming from the alpha and beta states. Now it's not the same loops as here, I just made some other loops here. So if, when we put the spins in, the spins in the alpha and beta states for the configurations that contribute, they have to be the same, because the spin basis is a complete orthogonal basis. So on each bond we have to have an antiparallel spin configuration, and because we form these closed loops, then that means that we have to have this up, down, down, up, and so on spin pattern on each loop. And there are 2 ways to do that, of course, and that's where this comes from. So if we have n loops, there are 2 to the n loop different spin configurations allowed, and this comes just from the fact that there's 1 over square root of 2 in front of each singlet. So this kind of expression now replaces what you are used to, the standard Kronecker delta as the overlap of 2 states in a complete orthogonal basis. So interestingly, what one can also express a lot of matrix elements using these loops. So we will, if we compute some correlation function or something like that, we would be interested in this kind of matrix element. So here it's the ratio of this S dot S operator to that overlap, and one can actually quite easily show that this matrix element vanishes if I and J are on different loops, which I here indicate by this loop index lambda. So we could put an index on each loop, like 1, 2, 3. So that vanishes unless I and J are in the same loop. And if they are, the value of this ratio is 3/4 times the sign. And the sign is just minus 1 if these guys are on different sublattices. And of course, you can see it here clearly for the Z component, that just corresponds to this up-down pattern of spins if we put the spins back in. If they are on different sublattices, on the same sublattice, it's a plus sign. And lots of other cases can be derived as well. There are some results in that paper. Okay, now many times I have promised to you I would show you the exact solution of this frustrated chain at that special value of the coupling ratio, which is called the Mashumdar-Ghosh point, after the people who first studied this model. So it's the frustrated Heisenberg chain, nearest neighbor and next nearest neighbor interaction. And as we have, I have claimed a couple of times at least, these states, where these again of course are the singlets, are exact eigenstates and in fact ground states at that ratio, coupling ratio. So let's look at that. It's quite simple, actually. So we have seen these singlet projector operators before, except now we don't see the 1/4 here. I don't know why it is there, but somehow the electronics has hidden it for us. I don't know why. So there should be a 1/4 here. So this is the singlet projector operator, which if you act on a singlet, you get 1. If you act on a triplet, you get 0. And you see that, as we have done before, this is the Heisenberg interaction except for sine and that constant. So if we write our Hamiltonian in terms of the projection operators, this is what we get. And here I just set J1 equals 1 and J2 equals g, so g is the ratio, and I just put one in front. So now let me show you some useful results that we need to prove that these are eigenstates. And okay, now I will not do every little detail. So these are some relationships that are very easy to prove just by simple calculation. So what I mean by these graphs is the following. If you take this kind of valence bond configuration, and I put the arrows in here to be really clear about the signs, and then I act with a singlet projector on sites B and C here, then what I get is the following. So that operator projects a singlet where it acts on B and C, and then those other two spins will also become connected in a singlet. It's quite clear in the sense that, okay, the singlet is projected there. So if we write the bonds like that, that means that the state here on B and C is in some linear combination of singlet and triplet, right? So the singlet component is projected out. And since this is a rotationally invariant operator and I act on a singlet, the state still has to remain a singlet, so then the only possibility is really that those also get connected in a singlet. And to prove this, if you really want to do it, just write these in terms of the up and down spins and this in terms of the diagonal and spin flipping parts, and you, in a couple of minutes you can convince yourself that that is the case. And there is a factor 1/2 in front of it. Okay, so same thing if I act on some other sites. So here B and C were on different sublattices. Here B and D are on different sublattices. You get this one, and note it's just the difference in terms of, I mean, you have to keep track of signs, and here I do that by those arrows. So here the arrows point in the same direction, here the arrows point in opposite direction. So this conforms to our convention that the arrows point from sublattice A to B always. We didn't even make a convention for bonds that connect the same sublattice because we just, in fact, restricted our basis to only have bonds that connect the two different sublattices. So these states are not even in the basis that we normally work with, but of course they're still valid states. If we want to get back to the basis that is more restricted, we can use this relationship, which is again something you just calculate by brute force to show. So that bond configuration is equivalent to a sum of two bipartite bond configurations like this, where there's a minus sign here. These are the relationships now that we are going to use to prove that those are eigenstates. So we take some segment of this chain, and I have drawn it here, or I mean of this state. So a singlet, so it could be these two here. And now I'm going to act with those operators in the whole Hamiltonian that correspond to those parts. So I'm going to act on those two bonds here, which is a J1 interaction, and on that bond there. So this is some fraction of the whole Hamiltonian. So the whole Hamiltonian can be written as, so you see I put in 1/2 here. So I really have one there, but I overcount these bonds. So if I translate this many times, I overcount these bonds, but not those bonds. So this is really 1 over n of the whole Hamiltonian. It's the part of the Hamiltonian acting on that thing. So let's see what happens when I act on that state. Well, we just use these relations here. So what you get, let's see, acting here, nothing happens because it's on a singlet, so I get this with a half. Acting there, I use this rule, and I have a half there and a half there, so I get a quarter. And then acting there, I use that rule, and this is what I get. with g over 2. Now I just use this relationship to get rid of that one, and then this is what I get. So now you see, here I have 1 half plus g over 2 times my original bond configuration. Here I have another bond configuration, but the factor is a quarter minus g over 2. So if g is 1 half, this cancels out. And I'm left with this one with factor 1. Factor 3 quarters, whatever. So that means if g equals 1 half, this was an eigenstate of that operator. And then you can easily see that since this was all the operators on those things, if I just translate it, repeat it with all my part Hamiltonian parts, I can prove that it's an eigenstate everywhere. So that's really the proof that it's an eigenstate. Now it does require a little bit more work, and it's a little bit subtle actually to show that it's also the lowest eigenstate, so that it's the ground state. So I will not do that here, but at least now you can believe that this Mashumdar-Ghosh point has those states as eigenstates and in fact also ground states. All right, okay, let's move on to another kind of states. So-called amplitude product state. So this was the general form of these valence bond states, summing over all these singlet tilings of the lattice, and this was my shorthand notation. So let's look at these coefficients here. So I already said that for a bipartite lattice, those can be all positive if we are interested in the ground state, or let's say we are interested in approximating the ground state. So let's look at coefficients of this form. So what does this mean? So this is a form that was introduced by Phil Anderson and his student and postdoc 20 years ago now. So R refers to the length of a bond. I mean, it's a vector. To be clear. So here R would just be 1, here R would be whatever that vector is, and so on. So refers to the length of a bond. And then for each possible length, we define some number, which is a positive number, an amplitude. So what we do when we have a configuration, we just go and count how many bonds do we have of all the possible lengths. So we have some bonds of length 1 and some of length, 3 and blah, blah, blah. And then we say that the coefficient is just a product of all those amplitudes. So we can write it in terms of going over all possible sizes of the bonds and counting how many of them we have. So it's the same as just looking at each of them and taking the product for each of them separately. Why would we like to do something like this? Well, I guess they just had the intuition that this might actually lead to good variational states. So we can regard these amplitudes as adjustable parameters, and we would like to adjust them in such a way to minimize the energy. That's the variational procedure. So to do that, we can, except for some very small systems maybe, we cannot do that analytically. We have to do it numerically. So we would like to do some calculations, use some optimization method, and then try to get the best energy we can. So how would we do it? Well, we actually would use variational quantum Monte Carlos. What does that mean? So it means, given a set of amplitudes, meaning for each possible bond length, I have a number given to me, one can actually compute with these states using Monte Carlo simulation. So the simplest way, which was used by these people, is to start with some arbitrary bond configuration and then do some two bond reconfiguration. So if you just take something like that and this A, B, C, D, those are completely arbitrary. We just satisfy this sublattice connection requirement. Then we can reconfigure. There are exactly two ways for those four sites that we can satisfy our requirement of connecting different sublattices. So what we can do is we can toggle between those two ways. So if we find this way, when we select those sites, we can try to change it to that way. And given the amplitudes and the rules I just gave to you for computing overlaps and matrix elements, we can compute the change in this amplitude when we do that, and that reflects also a change in the overlap of the state and so on. So one can do a Monte Carlo process to sample those states according to the weight in that kind of wave function. Now one can actually do something more efficient as well, but I don't have time to go into that. So if we, you will see it if we have time, you will see something similar a little bit later when we actually put the spins back into this. So we can actually think of this as sampling spins that are compatible with these bonds. If we do that, we can do some more efficient Monte Carlo samplings as well, but that's not so important here. Let me just show you some results. It's quite interesting. So you may ask yourself, well, what do those amplitudes look like as a function of the bond length? In fact, what we just looked at, this Mashunda-Ghosh state, is actually also an amplitude product state. It's an extreme case where the amplitude is 1 for bonds of length 1 and 0 for all other bonds. So what does the amplitude look like as a function of distance or as a function of the length of the bond? It turns out that they decay like 1 over r cubed in the case of the 2D Heisenberg model. And in fact, this should be general, so this should hold for any nil state, most likely, in two dimensions on a bipartite lattice. In three dimensions, actually, there's some prediction that it should be, well, the general prediction is 1 over r to the power of dimensionality plus 1. So this is the what one gets for 2. D equals 2. Then you can ask, well, how good is this state? Meaning, how well does it reproduce the actual ground state of this model? And of course, we don't know the actual ground state rigorously, but we have seen, and you will do it in practice today in the tutorial, that we can use quantum Monte Carlo to compute various properties very accurately with quantum Monte Carlo. Well, okay, you cannot compute everything extremely accurately, but for example, you can compute the energy very accurately, you can compute the sublattice magnetization, also the spin stiffness, as we will do today. So what I show here is, let's look at the energy first. I show what I get with this variational procedure. Okay, I did not tell you anything about here how I actually optimize those amplitudes. I told you a little bit about how to sample the states to compute some things. That was for a fixed set of amplitudes. Then there's some pretty standard procedure how to optimize in a multidimensional space of all these amplitudes. So for a system of size n, which here is L times L, the number of different amplitudes is also proportional to n. So if the system is big, you really have a lot of amplitudes. So it's not completely easy to optimize. But okay, one can optimize them. This is what one gets for the energy per site as a function of the system length. And here I go up to 80. The curve actually continues. What I call projected here is actually based on quantum Monte Carlo of the type I may have time to talk to you about in 5 or 10 minutes. So again, it should be something which is essentially exact within error bars. And here you cannot even see error bars. They are so small. So you see here that the error in the energy is something like less than 0.1%, which is really quite good when we talk about variational wave functions for quantum many-body systems. You rarely see such good variational energies. And if you look at something like the sublattice magnetization, which is reflecting of the correlations, we also get something very good. In fact, something which is good to 1% or so, which is really quite amazing. You see here that the curve is not very smooth. So the projected, which is essentially the exact result, is quite smooth. But this variational method has some jumps. And why is that? Well, that's because this optimization method that we use is not perfect. And actually, for big systems, the energy is not very sensitive to exactly what the sublattice magnetization is. And since we use the energy to variationally optimize, it's easy to get the energy, but quantities that can vary a lot without the energy changing a lot are not so easy to get. So that's why there are some fluctuations here. So those deviations here most likely reflect mainly incomplete optimization of the state. But regardless, it's clear that these amplitude product states are really quite good. Okay, so how about projector Monte Carlo? The result I already showed you was a result of that. Well, we have discussed projection before in the context of the Lanczos method, so you already know what it is. So if you take a high power of the Hamiltonian, here I just put a minus sign in front just to make things positive, because the ground state energy, for example, is typically negative. So if we act with that high power, eventually we should project out the ground state if n is sufficiently large. So let's look at this kind of scheme in the valence bond basis for the Heisenberg model. Again, I write it in terms of these projection operators. So what do we get now? So now the idea is to stochastically do this projection, meaning we want to sample some contributions to this projection. So we have h to the n, and you have already seen in the SSE method how we deal with that. We write that as a all possible strings of the bond operators which enter in H. Now I write the bond operators like this, so I don't separate diagonal and off-diagonal terms as we did in SSE. We just have those bond operators. So H to the N acting on some psi, and now this psi could actually be those amplitude product states, because those are already good variational states. It could also be just some arbitrary valence bond state. Now you get that as summing over all possible products of these singlet projection operators. I will show you a figure in a moment. And eventually that will go to the ground state times some irrelevant prefactor. And now we would like to sample that. Well, let's again look at, we already did that. If when these singlet projection operators act, we have two possibilities. We act on a bond, and then that operation is diagonal with eigenvalue 1. If we act between two bonds, and in this case the bonds will also between two sites, and the sites will always be on different sublattices, we are considering a bipartite Heisenberg model, we get this reconfiguration of spins. So when we act with a whole string of operators, what we are going to get is we start with some bond state, and then these bonds are going to be reconfigured pairwise as this projection proceeds. And the weight of that kind of string of projections will be given by this 1/2 to the number of those reconfigurations that we get. So here, when we are going to do something stochastically, it's really crucial that there's no minus sign here. Because again, we are going to do something where the weights will be treated as relative probabilities. So if we had some minus sign here, we would have a sign problem. And in fact, if we try to do this for a frustrated system, we would get a sign problem. So we cannot really do frustrated systems, although people, including myself, are working hard to try to see if we could somehow generalize this to frustrated systems. Okay, let's now look at some pictures. And let's look at an expectation value. So normally, of course, we would like to compute an expectation value where this is the ground state. I already showed you this string of operators. Now I just want to give it a shorthand name. So for some given string, there are many of them, I just call it PK. So K is just an index that formally labels all the possible strings. If I have a system with NB of these bond operators, formally the number of different strings is NB to the power of N, where N is the length of the string. Okay, that's just some notation. So now when we measure the expectation value, we have to project out these ground states from some what we call trial states. So we do that from the left and from the right. So acting on some state on the right, we have a sum over all those strings of operators, and that gives us the ground state. And we can say, okay, we act with some strings that are just this string written in the opposite order on a bra state, and that gives us the ground state. This is more clear if I show you a picture, which I do here. So let's say this is the trial state that we start from. This is a one-dimensional chain of six spins, and I just have a valence bond state like that Mashumdar-Ghosh state that I start from. So that's the state from which I want to project out the ground state. So now I have that on the right and on the left because I want to measure an expectation value. Okay, so now these strings of operators, I denote the operators by bars between the spins on which the operators act, exactly as we did in the SSC method, except now there are no diagonal and off-diagonal operators. There's just one bond operator, which is the singlet projection. So then we look at the rules for the singlet projection. So here we have an operator acting on those two spins. It's acting on a bond, so nothing happens. That state is exactly as before. The next operation, however, does act between two sides. So we project the singlet there, and then you remember that those other two sides will also be connected to a singlet. So, and the next one also does something. So this was just an example of where we have just three operators. Normally we would have many of them, thousands or even millions of them. Well, depends on how big the system is also. So on that side also something happens. And now what we get here on the left and the right is that we get, when we sample over all the possible strings here, we get the ground state, so we can measure something in between there, so we just put some operator there. So in terms of this notation where the string was called P, this is what we have. We have the operator there between those projected states, and we have to sample over all, or we have to sum over all locations of those operators. And this is just the normalization, because the states are not normalized. Each of these projections, as you remember, is associated with a factor. So each time I have this kind of reconfiguration here, I get a factor 1/2. So this is just writing that formally in terms of some weights of these paths. We can think of this as a sort of path integral as well. So we cannot sum over all these things exactly when we have a lot of them. So again, the trick is to do Monte Carlo sampling. Now we have to sample over those bond locations of those operators, and I will not get into the details how to actually do that. But the simplest way is just to change the location of one or a few of them recompute the weight and accept and reject as one does in the Metropolis algorithm. And these expectation values here, as I mentioned, they can be expressed normally in terms of the loops that are formed when those bond states are superimposed on each other. Okay, so that was a projection method expressed purely in terms of valence bonds. You have a question?
Yeah, just a quick
question.
Are the C0 cost normalization
the
normalization?
The normalization?
The C0
normalization. Yeah, so we don't know what this is. This is formally, it's the size of the component of the ground state in the starting state, the trial state that we work on. But the thing is, we don't need to know it, because in the end we will normalize, right? So those things will cancel out in this ratio here. That's why we don't need to know it, right? Because you project here and here and here and here, and exactly the same thing. So exactly the same C naught will appear as a square here and here, and it cancels out. So that's the good thing. It's not something we need to know. Okay, that was a projection method expressed purely with valence bonds. It turns out that you can actually do it more efficiently if you put the spins back in. So singlet means up, down, minus, down, up, right? So instead of doing this with in the way I just showed, we can actually do it in a way which starts to remind us a lot of the SSC method, namely, here I have four sites. I have two valence bonds. I can now also sample the spin states. So for each valence bond, I have two possibilities for the spins. Let's forget about the sign for now. So I can have up, down, or down, up here. Okay, if I have it express it in terms of the spins, and furthermore, I subdivide my bond operators in the diagonal part and off-diagonal part exactly as we do in SSE, then all the configurations start to look exactly as SSE. So now you see here I have an off-diagonal operator, and here I have actually, unfortunately, an error, it seems, because these spins should be the same. I have to correct that. I think I already did somewhere else, but I forgot to put the new. Yeah, so this operator is, there's something wrong here. So it should look like SSE, where, like, if you look here, the spin states are the same there and so on. The difference is that when we do SSE or path integrals in general at finite deep, we close the boundaries here. Now instead we have two sort of end cap states here, and those end cap states are valence bonds. And as you see, suggested by this picture here, those valence bonds actually continue the loops. So these are the loops that we discussed before. We can construct loops. But now the loops actually, instead of closing on the other side, they actually are continued along the valence bond. Because if we flip a spin here, that spin is connected to another spin with a valence bond, that means that spin has to be flipped as well, because we have to have up, down, or down, up. So it in the end, it really looks very much the same as SSE. The only difference is that you also have some state here. And I have discussed this sampling in terms of just some fixed state at these end caps. But in fact, one can sample those as well. So for example, you can have some Monte Carlo update where you change the loops here. So for example, this loop could go, let's see, in this case it's not possible, I guess. Here you could change these two bonds to close like that instead, and that would change the loop structure over there. So that can be done. It becomes very similar actually to finite T methods. One can study quite large systems, and that's what we have been doing since some time. Okay, now in the last 15 minutes, let me discuss this JQ model, which has a phase transition between an L state and a valence bond solid state. I already introduced the model and showed some preliminary illustrative results for you. Now let me show you just a little bit more. And these results were actually calculated with this valence bond quantum Monte Carlo. Most of it is from this paper and some older papers as well. One can actually do also SSE for this model, and there are some papers on that as well. Okay, so we talked about the JQ model, so let me just remind you. We write all these interactions in terms of the singlet projectors again. So the Heisenberg model itself is just a sum of singlet projectors, and we just illustrate it on the square lattice like that. And of course we include the horizontal projectors as well as the vertical ones and sum over all bonds on all nearest neighbor bonds on the lattice. The JQ2 model would correspond to having an interaction with two projectors like that, and again the one with the horizontal orientation of the bonds as well. And the JQ3 model would correspond to having bonds like that. And you can imagine putting any kind of bond arrangement you like, and you may get different kinds of states and so on. So the point of this JQ model originally was to try to realize the phase transition between an L state and a valence bond solid state in a model which can be studied using quantum Monte Carlo without sign problems. Because as you recall, these frustrated models that may have similar states and transitions, due to the frustration, we cannot do much for them. So let's look at some quantities. We have discussed these things before. So we need the sublattice magnetization. We have discussed that many times before. So we compute the square of the sublattice magnetization. Here I seem to call it uppercase M. I call it lowercase before. Doesn't matter, of course. And then we have the order parameters for this. Let's assume we have a columnar valence bond solid. We need to construct an order parameter for it. We already discussed that a little bit, but let's look at it again. So let's look at this dx here, which is a sum of S dot S operators that are nearest neighbors on the x direction. So if we have a state like that, when S dot S acts on the bonds, we get a large number, we get -3/4. When we act between the bonds, as you remember, we formally reconfigure the bonds, and in the end we have to take some overlaps and compute expectation values. But if you just think of it in some sort of classical way for now, the point is that S dot S will be large on these bonds, it will be small on those bonds, and it will be small also on those bonds. Yeah?
Is there any advantage of picking the HTV operator as columnar instead of maybe two columns on one horizontal?
One could do that, and that may give you some other phase. So. These are the ones that would be most appropriate for getting this kind of state, but there are many possibilities one could do. I don't know, why do you think that would be an advantage?
Because if diagnostically, if I have such fluctuation, like I have something like this, I have this, that, like, it's, for me, it would be more stable.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure. I mean, we can discuss it after. There are actually many possibilities what one could do. So, you know, your suggestion may be a good one. Anyway, if we look at, go back to these order parameters, okay, this is clearly then, at least if you think of it classically, but it's true quantum mechanically. So this is something that will be large in that kind of configuration. But notice that I have this phase factor here, so it can be depending on how this is oriented. I could also shift it by one, right? Then it can be positive or negative in some sense. And for dy, that will be large if I have one which is rotated by 90 degrees. And again, if we just look at these expectation values, exactly because in the simulation I don't really break any symmetry. So if I have this kind of state, then in the simulation I will sample over all the four ways of arranging it on the lattice, and the expectation values of these dx and dy's by themselves would vanish, and that's why we look again at the square order parameter. So let me show you some results for those things. So now we look at the JQ2 and JQ3 models, and this was done actually by my student GLO at BU, and now he's at ISSB in Tokyo, postdoc there. So he liked to define this kind of coupling ratio. So the Q divided by Q plus J. So then we know that when this Q term vanishes, we should have just the nail order of the 2D Heisenberg model. So that would correspond to this little Q going to zero. I told you already, I showed some result before, that when we have only the Q term, meaning this little Q goes to one, then we have VBS order. Now let me show you some results for that phase transition. So these show some scaling plots. We have looked at finite size scaling before, so you I think you, if you remember that, you understand what this is. So this is let me tell you what it is first. So let's look at this JQ2 data. So this is these order parameters, m squared and d squared. So you see, this is the d, the dimer, and this is m, the spin. And I have multiplied by l to some powers that correspond to a critical exponent. And on the x-axis, I have my student did estimate the critical point, QC, and then taking the deviation and multiplying by L to the 1 over nu, where nu is the correlation length exponent. So this kind of data collapse you would expect to get at a continuous quantum phase transition if those exponents are chosen correctly. So the scaling collapse involves fitting to QC, eta S, eta D, and nu. And you can see that these correlation functions, or these order parameters, they collapse very well for both these models, and the exponents that you get are even in very good agreement with each other. So this is some sort of support to the notion that this NEL to VBS transition really is continuous and it's universal. It has the same, you get the same exponents for different models. So there's still a lot of work that should be done, and this is being done by several groups on this thing. Some people don't actually like to believe that this is a continuous transition. There are all kinds of proposals that it has to be first order eventually and so on, which I don't believe, but anyway, this is work in that is still ongoing. So now, in the last 5 minutes, let me tell you one interesting aspect of this transition. So we have been talking about this kind of columnar valence bond solid. There's also another type, or actually many other types, but in this kind of model, there's another type of VBS that we could have, and that's called the Claquette VBS. So here I draw these squares, and you see I have red bonds and vertically and blue bonds horizontally. So you should think of this as a superposition. So that square you should really think of as the superposition of those two. So more or less, if you take a snapshot, you should think of it as having half of the bond pairs vertically and half of them horizontally. Okay, so what we do in this valence bond simulation, we sample the ground state in terms of valence bond configurations. So these are valence bond configurations. And we generate this wave function probabilistically. So we generate bond configurations, and the probability of them appearing correspond to the wave function coefficient there. So as I already said, if we compute these dx and dy order parameters as expectation values, we should get zero because of the not breaking the symmetry in the simulations. But what we can still do is we can look at the probability distribution of dx and dy. So for a given configuration in my simulation, I have a state on the right, I have a state on the left, and I can measure that dx as just a matrix element and divide by that overlap. So that's again something that should be, can do dx and dy. So dx has this s, dot s in the x direction and this in the y direction. So if I have this kind of state, dy should be large and it could be positive or negative depending on if it's shifted up or down. And then I can make a histogram of the probability distribution. And why do I want to do that? Well, you will see in a moment. If we have a columnar state and I don't break the symmetry in the simulation, I would expect to get a histogram like that. Because if I have something like this, dy would be large and dx would essentially be zero. If I flip it over 90 degrees, it should be vice versa. If I have a Plaquette state, on the other hand, as I already said, you can think of this in some sense as half of the bond pairs vertically and half of them horizontally. So if you sum over all such possibilities, then you can see that both dx and dy will be large at the same time. And depending on exactly how I shift this thing on the lattice, I would get one of these four peaks. So you see that the peaks are rotated by 45 degrees relative to that case. So by looking at these histograms, we could see which kind of state we have. So actually, I always discussed it to you in the sense that I know for sure that it's a columnar state, but technically I don't. Because the d squared that we have looked at would be large in either state. Right? So it's not sensitive to the kind of order parameter. Well, as we go to a critical point, so this should be the case inside the valence bond solid phase, as we go to a critical point, those peaks should become bigger and blur together in the middle here. Okay? Alright, so let's see what we actually get. So this is again where the proposals we want to test, and this is what we get. So, doesn't look anything like it, and why is that? So instead of four peaks, we get, I hope you can see, it's sort of a circle. This is the probability distribution if I just make a cut through it, so you can see that there are, the weight is not in the middle as you expect at a critical point, where these four points just come together, but it's circular. Well, in this theory of deconfined corner criticality, this is actually expected, and I don't have at all time to discuss why and how. But the point is that theory predicts what's called an emergent U1 symmetry. This is U1 symmetric, right? Instead of these being Z4 symmetric, fourfold symmetric. So what is predicted is that if you have this kind of deconfined quantum critical point, when you approach that point, these circles or these blobs here will start to broaden out in the angular direction, which means that you start to get, let's say you have this kind of state, you start to get fluctuations of pairs that bring you closer to that kind of state. So these guys should start to broaden out in the angular direction, also in the other direction. And there's a length scale associated with that, and that length scale is supposed to be a power of the correlation length with this A larger than 1. And it's also associated with this spin on deconfinement, but I don't have time to discuss exactly how. But the point is that there's another length scale in the system. And even if I'm inside the valence bond phase, where if I go to an infinite lattice, eventually I should see something like this or something like that, the prediction is that if the lattice is smaller than that length scale, then I should not see these four peaks. I should actually see a circular histogram, and that's actually what is seen. So this is something which hints to this transition actually being of that unusual kind. Now, it would be nice to be able to see these four peaks emerge. So if we go to a very big system, we should eventually see it. But in this model, at that time, I could not see it. But then we started to work on this JQ3 model, which has a, let's say, more robust valence bond order. So there was some hope to see it there. So these are results, similar results, but for the JQ3 model. And this is the critical point in that case is around 0.6 for this coupling ratio. And this is at 0.635 and the same system size as before. And we see it looks quite similar to what I had on the previous graph. But in this model, we can go much further into the ordered state. So if we go to Q equals 0.85, actually we see those four peaks. So this means that at this coupling ratio, that new length scale lambda is actually much larger than 32, so I cannot see those four peaks. But here, as I go deeper inside the valence bond solid phase, that length scale is shorter than 32, and now I can see the four-fold symmetry. So one can also do some finite size analysis of histograms like that and get some information about the exponent that relates these two length scales, and we did that as well. And I think that's the last thing I wanted to say here. So I guess we finished on time, more or less. Okay, so that's it. That was really nice to talk to you. Thank you.
We'd also like to thank you for lecturing to this small but dedicated group and award you with this
Well, thank you. I hope I don't have to try it on immediately.
You don't have to try it on immediately, but if it doesn't fit, let us know.
Looks like it should fit. Thanks a lot.